A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 139. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. Yes, Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons, 1967 Super Marionation puppet show from Gerry Anderson for the ITV network. We've talked about Gerry Anderson before, and we've got another one of his shows here, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. We talked about Thunderbirds, which was a very popular Gerry Anderson Super Marionation puppet show. We talked about that in British Invaders 65 and 66. And after that was done, he went on to look at other things, and one of them was this series, Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons, which was a science fiction action-adventure show, definitely for children, and it dealt with the battle, or even the war, against this mysterious alien force.
That's right, the Mysterons, and we've been watching 32 episodes. They're 25 minutes long. As regular listeners may know, this is one of my favorite shows. I'm quite excited about us talking about this. And possibly this is the Gerry Anderson team at the height of their powers, something we'll get into as we go along. But, you know, this is the production company in full swing and a very popular show from the 60s.
Yes, I think for a Super Marionation show from them particularly, this was sort of one where they had really come and resolved a lot of their issues and really refined it to get something that was quite strong.
Okay, so the setup of the show, it's 2068, and Spectrum is a world security force, which is characterized by its color-coded agents, so obviously Captain Scarlet. And we meet them sort of early on a strange expedition.
Yes, that's right. We see this expedition to Mars with Captain Black in this sort of Martian exploration ground vehicle, looking to investigate these strange radio signals they've been picking up. And what they discover is a full-scale alien base. And in fact, they see something there that appears to be targeting them directly and appears to be this weapon system targeting this exploration vehicle from Spectrum. This exploration vehicle happens to be quite heavily armed for some reason. And Captain Black opens fire and they openly attack the Mysterons, who were not actually attacking. It was just a sensor array. They were looking to see what these people from Earth were doing and wanted to welcome them. And inadvertently, Captain Black starts this major conflict.
Yes, and one of the things for me is to see how this show stands up to my memories from it as a child. And actually, when watching the opening episode, I hadn't really remembered that it's actually Spectrum who start the war with the Mysterons. As you say, Brian, it's sort of inadvertently, but it's a sort of war crime right at the start. And the result is that the Mysterons fight back and they attack Earth. And in the first episode, we see the results of their first attack, with Captain Scarlet, the hero of the show, being apparently taken over or replaced by the Mysterons. And he's under their power. And at the end of the first episode, he apparently falls to his death. But in doing so, this seems to break him free of Mysteron control, and he becomes an indestructible agent of Spectrum, and in fact, Spectrum's lead weapon in the fight back against the Mysterons.
Yes, that's right. The Mysterons have a very strange set of powers, and this was something that I sort of liked, that we never know exactly what the Mysterons can and can't do. They are certainly able to kill or destroy, you know, they can kill people and replace them with Mysteron versions of a certain person, and they're making these agents of people that infiltrate into various places, and they do similar things with vehicles and the like, but it is clear that they must destroy things before they can sort of build their own copy versions that are under their control. So they have these sort of quite powerful and impressive things that they can do, but it's definitely not clear at all times exactly what they can do.
A strange and mysterious force from outer space attacking the Earth.
Absolutely. So we should get into some of the characters here. Obviously, the first one is Captain Scarlet. We find out along the way that the character's name is actually Paul Metcalf. The voice is done by Francis Matthews, and he is Spectrum's main agent, or he becomes almost Spectrum's main weapon, because we know from this sort of odd situation in the first episode that he becomes indestructible. You know, he can be attacked and shot and apparently killed and always recovers and is able to continue on. So he, of course, is very central to things, and he is often working with a character called Captain Blue, voiced by Ed Bishop, an American actor who we've talked about a number of times, working in Britain and being in British shows. And Captain Blue is sort of Captain Scarlet's best friend and his partner as an agent. And very often we have the two of them together working on some mission to defeat a scheme by the Mysterons.
That's right. And yes, nice to hear Ed Bishop, who was, I think, a frequent collaborator with Gerry Anderson. And he's cropped up in other Gerry Anderson shows, most notably UFO, which we've talked about in the past. We've also got the leader of Spectrum, the head of Spectrum, Colonel White, voiced by the distinguished actor Donald Gray. He sits in the floating cloud base of Spectrum. He sits at a rather typical Gerry Anderson rotating desk, and it's his voice of command and authority that usually tells us what's going on in the fight back against the Mysterons. And of course, he briefs Captain Scarlet and Captain Blue and usually assigns them to their mission. So that's Colonel White. We've also got the communications officer sitting nearby him on Cloud Base, Lieutenant Green, voiced by the actor Cy Grant. And he, again, is responsible for passing on Colonel White's orders to Scarlet and Blue, and also to the pilots of the Angel Interceptor craft.
They were an interesting lot, weren't they?
They were, yes. I mean, we have, again, typically for a Gerry Anderson show, we have some interesting vehicles, which we'll get to, and the fighter jets, or the Angel Interceptors, were all crewed by women, all with code names, Destiny, Symphony, Melody, Rhapsody, and Harmony Angels, who were voiced by, amongst others, I think, Liz Morgan, Jana Hill, Leanne Shin, and Sylvia Anderson herself did one of the voices. So Colonel White and Lieutenant Green will send the Angels into action frequently to fight back against Mysteron attacks.
Yes, the Angels were definitely an unusual group of characters in there, with each one having a different accent from a different country or region. So that was definitely a little bit unusual and something that had sort of a different swing to things.
That's right. Yeah, so we talked about it when we covered UFO, that Gerry Anderson shows do have this sort of multinational, multicultural, multiracial approach, which was quite unusual for the 60s and, you know, very commendable.
Yeah, I think that was done quite well on this show as compared to some of his earlier ones. But yeah, that was definitely there. And as we'll discuss a little bit later, I think having the team of women and their high fashions and so on was a big influence from Sylvia Anderson.
Yes.
Now, the other key character we have in here, of course, is Captain Black, also voiced by Donald Gray, who voiced Colonel White. And Captain Black was the Mysteron's main agent on Earth. He is killed and replaced by this Mysteron double very early in the series, in the first episode. And he has a sort of very gray pallor to his face and this deep and rather eerie voice. And he is sort of an ongoing villain who turns up in a variety of ways. He is often the face and the voice of the Mysterons for us.
And yes, as you say, he's a clear-cut villain. He looks the villainous part with his sort of pallid face and his heavy sort of beard growth, as it were, and his sunken dark eyes. And he's sort of like the polar opposite to the clean-cut hero looks of Captain Scarlet himself. So yes, our villain.
Yes, for sure.
This is the voice of the Mysterons. We know that you can hear us, Earthmen. You will pay for your unprovoked attack on our complex on Mars. We will be avenged. We will assassinate the Director General.
Now that brings us to talk about the Mysterons and about Spectrum, the two opposing organizations. The Mysterons, we never really see them directly. What we do see as the indication of their presence are these two green circles of light that sort of shine over and across objects and people. So when you see these two light circles moving across things and sort of taking on their shape as they move across, and there are musical cues and things that go with that, it gives you something that tells you that they're there. And as we mentioned, they have this ability to produce exact copies of anything that they've destroyed. And that includes copies of people. So they make these agents working for them. And they have this sort of strange set of powers we never quite understand. They are able to do things like make vehicles and machinery malfunction and cause it to be destroyed that way. And, you know, the beginnings and ends of what they can do, it's never quite clear. And that was something I thought worked fairly well.
Yes, there's certainly mystery about them, about this alien race with no physical form. And as you say, they take on, or they have dead people become their agents somehow or other. And, you know, there's other strange things. Apparently, Mysteron agents can disappear into thin air. That's shown in a couple of episodes. And we have, of course, the voice of the Mysterons, which is the voice of Captain Black. And we will hear the plans of the Mysterons voiced by Captain Black and announced to Spectrum, along with these moving green circles of light. So it's all quite sort of spooky and sinister stuff when that happens, I think, Brian.
Yes, absolutely.
And of course, we've got their opposites. We've got Spectrum defending the world, a world security force based in their floating cloud base, which looks like an airborne aircraft carrier. We have the color-coded agents. So we've mentioned Captain Scarlet and Captain Blue, Lieutenant Green. We'll come across other colors as we go along. Captain Magenta, I believe there's a Dr. Fawn, and so on. So several sort of colored agents. And as we've already mentioned, with Annie Jerry Anderson show, we have got some fantastic vehicles. So as well as the cloud-based carrier, we have the airborne angels in their sort of missile-like fighter jets, which launch from cloud base. But there's other vehicles as well that we should mention.
Yes, one of the key ones, they have the Spectrum Pursuit Vehicles, or SPVs, which are these very fast on-road and off-road cars that have the driver facing the rear and watching the road on a screen where it's projected and so on. These are heavily armored and armed, almost tank-like vehicles that they are driving around. And they are not all stored at some base somewhere, but they seem to be concealed and ready to use all over the place. So we very frequently have this situation where a Spectrum officer will get to the place they need to be and go to someone off in the middle of nowhere often and say, you know, I need SPV number 500 and something or number 1017 and show some ID. And sure enough, there is a Spectrum pursuit vehicle concealed in a shed somewhere or wherever it is. And they seem to be all over the world and anywhere that they might be needed.
Absolutely, yes. There's always one when they need one. And I think Gerry Anderson, he did love this idea of having vehicles concealed in sheds and boxes, because we've seen it in other shows as well. But yes, absolutely here, the SPVs. And interestingly, on the one of the documentaries which we've been watching, Gerry Anderson said that he came up with the idea of the rear-facing driver because there was some talk at the time that that would be safer for passengers in cars and trains and planes and so on. But I think he subsequently regretted it, because every episode they had the SPV in, they had to remember to explain that the drivers were facing the wrong way and how that worked.
Yeah, they did mention that on a few occasions, didn't they? And there were a number of other cars and planes and transporters and things. There was a larger plane that would have a couple people in it that sometimes Captain Scarlet would fly with Captain Blue. There were these smaller Spectrum vehicles that were sort of like a red, almost sports car like thing with a huge fin in the back. And as you would expect in any of these Gerry Anderson shows, there were quite a number of different vehicles in different situations, both Spectrum vehicles and vehicles with other organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. Lots to look at.
So we should get into our production notes here. Gerry and Sylvia Anderson, married couple at the time, had their Century 21 production company, and they had been pretty successful by this time, I think, with a number of different Super Marionation puppet shows. Things like Four Feather Fall, Supercar, Fireball XL5, Stingray, and of course Thunderbirds. And these had the general feeling of being these shows with lots of action and these puppet characters and lots of vehicles and lots of sci-fi ideas in them.
That's right. And they had their trademarked Super Marionation technique, which was a method of synchronizing the puppet's mouth with the actor's dialogue. And as you said, we've talked about it already on a previous British Invaders episodes. Thunderbirds was their biggest series before this. But Thunderbirds had been cancelled in 1966 because Lou Grade, the head of ITC at the time, had not been able to find a deal with an American broadcaster. And we did talk about this when we discussed Thunderbirds. It sort of ended reasonably abruptly in the second series. So that was cancelled.
Yes, in the 60s and 70s, for ITV shows and ITC shows that were broadcast on ITV in the UK, it was often a very big deal to get an American broadcaster and start bringing in some American money into a production. And this was something that often the shows would be made with an American audience and American broadcast standards in mind, along with the British ones, in order to get that extra distribution and get the extra money into it. And we saw that certainly with a lot of Gerry Anderson's work, and also with things like The Avengers and The Prisoner.
That's right, yes. They needed to sell them abroad, really, to continue making these shows, some of which had quite, you know, big costs involved. They were big productions.
So Grade and Anderson decided that rather than trying to sell a third series of Thunderbirds, doing a whole new concept instead might be easier to sell for the US. And Anderson had this idea of having a hero who would die at the end of each episode and somehow be able to reappear and be there again in the next episode. And they were looking at these news stories at the time that were talking about the possibilities that there could be life on Mars. And they wanted to do something with the idea of Martians, but they wanted something that would be completely different from anything that we had seen on film or TV at that point.
Yes, and, you know, Gerry Anderson certainly coming up with an alien race that was different to anything that had previously been encountered in science fiction television. And of course, at the time, as well as coming up with the new ideas, they were also making developments with their puppets. And in particular, two of Gerry Anderson's regular collaborators, who were puppeteers and producers in their own right, Reg Hill and John Reed, had worked out how to put the mechanism, the solenoid that lip-synced the puppet's mouth, and they'd worked out how to put this in the chest of the puppet instead of the puppet's head. And the obvious advantage of this was that for the first time with a Gerry Anderson puppet show, it meant that the puppets could have normal sort of proportioned bodies and heads. You may remember from Thunderbirds that the puppets have very large heads in respect, in sort of relation to the rest of their body, and look a bit strange. But with the Captain Scarlet puppets, we have a more sort of proportional size. They're quite large puppets. They're between 20 and 24 inches tall. Although rather interestingly, Brian, although their proportions were more realistic, the increased sort of mechanism in their chest actually made operating the puppets and making them walk more difficult. So in a way, the Captain Scarlet puppets are slightly less animated than their Thunderbird equivalents.
Yes, I think part of the reason for that was that once you made the puppets into these more realistic proportions, you would naturally start to expect and look to see more realistic motions. So in some sense, it was that the expectations that those puppets gave you were just a little bit different. So it was hard to achieve the level of detail in the motion that that you would want to see. In many cases, the puppeteers were actually something like 8 feet above. They'd have, you know, 8 feet of string or wire connecting to this 20 or 24 inch puppet. So getting these small, precise movements was quite difficult.
Okay. Interesting stuff.
Just to do a comparison to toy type things, it made the puppets look more like action figures and less like toys for small children or bobblehead toys or something like that. Now, in with this, we also had these transport devices that you had in the earlier Gerry Anderson Super Marionation shows as well. Rather than having a puppet get up and walk across the room, you would have some gadget where the chair that the character was sitting in would glide across the room. And there were some of these things. I think in some ways they relied on them a little less than they had in Thunderbirds. But you certainly had these devices that moved people around, because one of the few things that they really had difficulty with the puppets was getting them to walk realistically. So normally if they did walk, you would not see a full shot of them. You'd see sort of like a waist up shot where it's clear that the character is walking, but you don't really see it.
Okay, yeah. We also had, I think, the familiar cuts to real hands for operating buttons and so on, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. And it gives you sort of an interesting style some of the time whenever something has to be manipulated by a character, whether it's opening something with a key or controlling something on a control panel, handing something to someone. It has to be done with a close-up of the person's hands. And of course, it goes to a real person's hands then. And that sort of changes the style visually in some ways. And it meant for some props and things, they would need to have multiple versions. They would have to have a prop that is the right size for a person and a prop that's the right size for a 2-foot-tall puppet.
Interesting, yes, absolutely.
They also did something that was a little different. I don't think they had done this before, where some of the puppets they made to look like either the actors voicing them or famous actors or models. So particularly well known is the idea that Captain Scarlet, the main character himself, was made to look rather like Cary Grant. and Francis Matthews was doing something of a Cary Grant impression as the voice. So you have a bit of a sort of Cary Grant type character as the lead in this.
That's right, absolutely. And of course, it's a 60s show, so there were 60s personalities featured. So you may see a puppet that looks like Sean Connery, and apparently there's an Ursula Andress in there as well, in one of the angels. So yes, some modeling on real people.
Yes, and it definitely, you have a 60s look throughout and lots of 60s influences, so those things would fit in as well. The puppet operation was led by Mary Turner, and she did lots of work on how these motions would work and getting things to work with these puppets that have the different proportions than they had used before.
That's right. Another regular member of the Gerry Anderson team, and also another member, Derek Meddings, who we've mentioned before for his special effects model work, with his colleague Mike Trim doing the models here for Captain Scarlet. And of course, with any Gerry Anderson puppet show, or in fact even with their live action shows, they love to have explosions and they love to blow up their models. So there's fires, there's things going off, there's all sorts of detonations and excitements. And of course, all filmed in Slough near London at the Century 21 Studios, which they'd moved to, I think, before making Thunderbirds. We mentioned that as well.
Yes, and at this time, their model work with vehicles and spaceships and explosions and so on was getting to be very good and quite well respected. Apparently, according to the documentary on the DVD, they had people coming to them who were starting to work on 2001, A Space Odyssey, the famous film from the 60s. And apparently they asked Gerry Anderson and company, you know, will you guys do some of the model work and effects work on this? And they actually did not do that because at the time they were really only working on their own productions. But the things they were working on were at a level that people were coming to them and asking for things from major films like that. And I think there was also some interest from the James Bond films and having them do something. And in fact, Derek Meddings, who was one of the big special effects people on this, did go on to work on James Bond films in the 1970s.
So quite a reputation that Gerry Anderson was building with his production team for their model work and special effects. And I wonder if they were also building a reputation in the fashion world, Brian.
You know, it may be. The costumes were designed by Sylvia Anderson, who had particular fun, I think, with the off-duty uniforms for the Angels. The Angels, these female fighter pilots, it seemed like were almost doubling as fashion models for this show, which was a little interesting, a little different, and definitely, I think, sort of a Sylvia Anderson-style thing with lots of fashion coming in on this and lots of hairstyles and what have you. The stories, many of them were written and then also script edited by Tony Barwick. He wrote, I think, 18 out of the 32 episodes and script edited episodes as well. And Shane Rimmer, who we know as a Canadian actor who did North American voices on Thunderbirds and on many British shows, both these puppet shows and also live action things, and he was in James Bond films as well. He wrote 3 episodes for Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons, and he did some voices here and there as well.
Yes, you'll hear Shane Rimmer's voice, and it's very recognizable. And for us on British Invaders, it's a delight to hear him, especially as we had the great pleasure to meet him earlier this year.
Yes, that's right, of course.
And again, we talk about regular collaborators. Barry Gray wrote the music for Captain Scarlet, and it is fantastic music. In particular, the song that plays over the end credits, which was recorded by apparently a manufactured pop group of the time who were called The Spectrum, appropriately enough.
There were actually 2 recordings of the music for the end credits. If you watch different episodes, they don't always use the same one.
That's right. I don't think they don't use the pop song each time. I think they sometimes just use the straightforward music without the vocals, I think. Is that right?
There were 2 versions that both had vocals, and they were basically the same song, but one was the pop group, The Spectrum, doing it. And the other, I guess they were studio musicians, but it was a different recording of a similar version of the song. And they sort of started with one version and then switched to the one that was done by the Spectrum and then sort of switched back and forth a little bit and then eventually settled on the one from the Spectrum. Maybe it was just one switch in production order. I'm not sure.
Okay. And of course, that music is played over 10 very famous painted images of Captain Scarlet in peril, which were produced by a very well-known comic artist called Ron Embleton. And I've often talked about some of my favourite opening title sequences for these British Invaders shows. I think for an end title sequence, this possibly is one of the best, if not my all-time favourite, Brian.
It is very good. Those images from Ron Embleton look great. They really do. They have a really fun 1960s comic book look to them. And they don't look like the puppets at all. They're really meant to look like a comic book version. And you have this fun 1960s pop song, especially in the version by the Spectrum. So it is fun stuff. It's a really nice ending title sequence there.
Yes, fantastic stuff.
Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons began broadcasting on September 29th of 1967. It had this 5:25 p.m. time slot, which was always a big deal in the UK for sort of kids shows and things like that. It has been repeated multiple times over the years, and it was also successfully sold to 40 other countries or something like that, including the US and Canada. So it has been broadcast quite widely.
And I suppose in that regard, it was a success then for Gerry Anderson and Lou Grade in that they did manage to get it sold abroad. And over the years, it's gone on to be one of their most successful and I think best remembered shows. It's achieved a certain degree of cult status. So it's very well remembered.
Yes, that original series only had the one season, but that one season has certainly done well.
Okay, so the availability of that one season, we have 32 episodes, and here in Region 2, we have all the episodes collected on a DVD box set. That also includes Gerry Anderson commentaries on some of the episodes. It includes some original TV commercials. It also includes 5 audio stories, which were, I think, available on vinyl at the time, Brian, but they're here on the DVD set. And right at the end, there's also a documentary about the programme and the making of the programme, which is hosted by Captain Blue, voiced by Ed Bishop himself. So all in all, quite a nice DVD release, and it's beautifully presented. The discs are all decorated with the Spectrum logo. It's quite a lovely thing. It's about £18 for the box set here on Amazon.co.uk. It's also available on the rental site Love Film. And you can watch episodes on iTunes for 99 pence each, or, and I think this is quite a bargain, £10.99 for the whole season, if you want to get all 32 from iTunes. Meanwhile, in Region 1...
In Region 1, there is a similar DVD set that's available for about $30 on Amazon.com. For some reason, about $70 on Amazon.ca... But you can certainly get that from Amazon.com. It's not available on iTunes in the US or Canada, but that DVD set is available and it is on Region 1, which is great.
Good. And at the moment, there are one or two episodes appearing on YouTube. I'm not sure they stay up there very long, but you could go and look at the end credits as well, which are fantastic. So there are ways to watch this show, and it's definitely, you know, a box set that's worth having because it is so beautifully presented.
Yes, I would say the opening sequence and the closing sequence are both worth taking a look at to give you a bit of a taste and to see what this was like.
Okay, I guess that will wrap us up for our first part of our discussion.
I think so. Next time, we will discuss what the typical episodes were like, you know, a bit of the patterns they used, and talk about some of our favorite episodes and some different things in there. We will talk about some of the various spin-offs that were done from this, including a 2005 remake series and some other things as well.
And of course, we will be getting to our good and bad, our reviews and recommendations about this show. So quite a bit to talk about again when we come back in part two.
Yes, absolutely. You can reach us at britishinvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at britishinvaders.com. We are on the Geek Culture Network, so if you look at thegeekculturenetwork.com, you can find us along with some other podcasts. And we also have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find us there.
And you'll also now find us on the Voice of Geeks streaming internet radio at vognetwork.com. We have a time slot twice a week, and as ever, we welcome any listeners who are joining us through Vogue Network.
Yes, absolutely. We are broadcasting both old and new episodes of British Invaders on Vogue. And we also now have a forum on vognetwork.com. So as an alternative to Facebook, if you want to come in and discuss things with us and some of our other listeners on that forum, you can do that as well.
Please do. We look forward to suggestions, questions, comments, and criticisms.
Absolutely. Hopefully we can have some good discussions on this new extra forum. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you very much, and do come back and join us for part two. And until then, this is Eamon in England saying goodbye.